Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Welcome to another edition of the Unstoppable Mindset podcast, where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. And our guest today, Ole Kantos, is a little of all of those, especially the unexpected, as I think you'll see. Ole is a fascinating soul who's been around for a while, has a lot of interesting stories to tell. And on top of everything else, he's a lawyer. It's scary. At least he has a law degree, but he hasn't tried to sue me yet. So I think we're in good shape. But Ole, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I should say from the outset in talking about Ole that he is also blind, as I. We've known each other for quite a while, and we've been trying to get him on Unstoppable Mindset for quite a while, but his schedule is incredibly rigorous. So it has been a little bit of a challenge, but he confessed that he has actually been on vacation for a week, and so now we are able to get him and have him here. So I'd love you to talk a little bit about you and tell me a little bit about your life growing up as a blind person and anything that you'd like people to know about that.
Sure, Mike. Well, I was born 2 months premature, and as the result of medical complications, I was blind from birth from a condition called retinopathy of prematurity. And so in my particular case, I had that resulted in my being totally blind in my left eye and having partial residual vision in my right. And until about 2 years ago, it was pretty stable until some things that ended up happening because of an accident with being hit by a car. But that's a whole other story. But basically, when I was growing up, life was pretty intense because I was victimized by bullying a lot. And my parents really urged me to do everything I could to make sure to work hard and to achieve high results. And at the time when I was younger, I honestly didn't think that I could pretty much do much of anything. And I that's just being very transparent and honest with you. I just didn't think that there was much that was really possible because of having a limited vision. And so what ended up happening was there was this struggle between what my parents believed I could do and what I believed I could do. And so I tried to get out of chores. I tried to pretty much leverage my visual impairment to the best extent possible so I wouldn't have to do stuff. But it didn't work. It didn't work. My mom, she insisted that I do chores to the same degree of efficiency as kids who could see. And she also had me make sure to watch after my baby sister and clean up after her with stuff she leaves around, etc. And I really found it was just a tough existence, but not because my parents were awful to me, but more because I tried to just get out of stuff because I just didn't believe that it was really possible to do things to the same degree of efficiency. And as I grew up, it was quite a struggle because I read large print. And then when fourth grade hit, I ended up being in a position where the print got smaller, then it was harder to read. and so forth. But because I wasn't taught Braille in school, I just strained with what usable vision that I had. And that was a mistake because it meant that I was far more inefficient in comparison to other kids because I wasn't taught Braille. And so growing up and working through all of my challenges, I ended up doing okay academically, but it was not without a cost. I hardly had any social life and so forth, but I did work to get involved eventually with extracurricular activities and everything, but things were so much more of a struggle because I didn't know Braille. And I, at the time, had a very negative attitude about being thought of as, quote, blind, close quote. I felt that if I were thought of that way, that I would be segregated and I didn't want to look and be different in comparison to everybody else. And I actually would say, well, at least I'm not one of those blind people. And I look back now and think about those attitudes, but that's the way that I was taught. And that's what I came to believe. Like, well, hey, at least I'm not totally blind. So at least I have some vision. So at least, you know, I'm not one of them and I don't have to use one of those canes. And yet at the same time, it was tough because I would feel like I was closeted all the time where I tried to hide not being able to see well. And I was ashamed of who I was inside. And I always felt like I was hiding. And whenever I would get into some accident and I trip on something or I would bump into something or bump into someone, I'd say, oh, sorry, I wasn't paying attention. And I just downplayed it. But the whole time I just felt like, oh, my gosh, this is, you know, well, at least they don't know because I'm not using a cane. And then later, after starting to get involved with different organizations, I eventually came to know people in the National Federation of the Blind. And they're the ones who taught me very directly that it is respectable to be blind, that it's okay to use a cane. And because of that, I used a cane for the first time in my life. And eventually I learned Braille as an adult. I'm not nearly as fast as my children, which we'll get to later, but I still recognize the valuable importance of Braille, and I'm a staunch Braille advocate. And I really believe that even if people have some residual vision, the key is to recognize if Braille is more efficient than straining one's eye to read print. And so because of my life and the way things are, to this day, I am actually functionally illiterate in that sense. I can't pick up a book and read it straight through like my sons can. I'm not able to just read from a speech. I have to memorize things. So I continue to face those sorts of challenges because of how I learned Braille as an adult, which meant that it's just harder for me to read as quickly. That doesn't mean it isn't possible, but for me, that was an ongoing challenge. But in spite of all of that, I still eventually became an attorney. And I've been involved in the disability rights movement now for 30 years. And
tell me, how old were you when you started to use a cane?
I was 20 years old. I was a junior in college. Between the summer between my sophomore and junior year is when I went to the national convention. And so I left not using a cane. I came back using one. So that's a whole series of stories in and of itself.
Sure. Did you go through any formal orientation and training, or did you kind of teach yourself, or how did you really learn to be effective with it?
Well, it took a while. And then I went to the Louisiana Center for the Blind between college and between the end of my college years and the beginning of law school. So that's the time that I was in that setting. And I learned the blindness skills based on being put under sleep shade. And so everything I did, cook, clean, read, walk, travel, just anything, any of the various skills, I learned through the alternative techniques of blindness. And it was the best thing because it really was a confidence builder, because then after that, I knew that I would still be able to function, and that it really is true that when refining alternative techniques, then we can be as efficient or at least at a very minimum, far more efficient than we would have been if we just simply strained with what little we could see. If people want to be able to use their residual vision, that's absolutely fine, provided that it is not at the cost of efficiency. And so that's what I've come to realize. And that's why to this very day, I really push hard for Braille for kids as well as adults, and because of the value of that. And of course, technology these days has undergone such significant innovations. And concurrent with that, though, we still need to know the fundamentals of Braille, because it really can be a real booster of efficiency in the long run after we learn it.
There's a general consensus that the literacy rate in terms of Braille for blind people has dropped. Why is that?
Well, it's dropped because historically, in the 40s, the literacy rate among blind people was 90%. And that was when kids were in schools for the blind across the country. And then with the advent of the newer special education laws over the more recent decades, kids started learning in school alongside their peers without disabilities. And that is an important and valuable historical step. The difficulty was that because of how spread out various of us were, there wasn't necessarily access to quality Braille instruction because we are what's called, we have what's called low incidence disability. And so as a result of that, there isn't necessarily a lot of people to meet the demand for Braille instruction or providing Braille education. And so even though the law to this day presumes that a blind student should learn Braille, having actual access is another story in many instances.
Well, of course, the other part of that is that the general attitude, and it's kind of self-fulfilling, but the general attitude is, well, blind people don't need Braille because there are books recorded or other ways of doing it. And so the literacy rate has gone down, and now people use the argument, well, very few people, 10% read Braille. And so it clearly isn't the way to go. But the reality is that it does involve in part the educational system not learning that Braille is the true reading and writing method for blind people, which gets back to the whole issue of attitudes about blindness in the educational world, much less elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. And so if people fundamentally believe that it is not either respectable to be blind or that blindness somehow means that somebody has lower ability, then of course, at all costs, they will try to avoid anything associated with techniques that are utilized by people who are totally blind. That was literally my attitude for the first 20 years of my life. And I remember the very first day of first grade, they put Braille in my hands, but literally the next day it was gone. But that's the only time ever that I had been exposed to a Braille writer and so forth. And so it really does come down to attitudes about blindness. And it also means that we need to take an honest look at what we ourselves think about blindness, including people who are blind themselves. And they say, well, you know, there's a difference between totally blind and well, maybe I'm legally blind, you know, that sort of thing. And at least the way that I now believe when it comes to blindness, it's just fine to use the word. I mean, it's not a matter of merely changing the word or trying to say some other word about it, but it's actually more a matter of what we think about it, what we think about blindness. So if the community can come to a place where they recognize that regardless of the degree to which somebody cannot see, that they still will be able to compete on terms of equality if given the proper training and basic skills and the opportunity to succeed, then that's what will be really of significant help with not only expecting more of blind children, but also blind children expecting more of themselves, blind parents expecting more of them, the educational system expecting more of them, and ultimately when they grow up, them rising to those higher expectations, as opposed to when members of our community end up having lower expectations, they don't do as much, so then therefore it's self-fulfilling prophecy. And because of that, they say, see, look at how most people these days who are blind don't read Braille, or the unemployment rate is very, very high. And so we just have to look at, there's always a societal tension between the way things used to be and the way things are. And things can either get gradually worse or gradually better, but there are always these constant forces that come up against each other. And so from everything that I have seen in my life and from raising my kids, The key philosophically is to believe that our children can grow up to be whatever they want, and that whenever they do achieve things, the source of inspiration would be that because they work hard and just like anybody else. But we have got to be careful about being inspired by people with disabilities who just do average things. So let's say, for example, Mike, I don't know if this has happened to you, probably has, where I've crossed the street with my cane, you know, I cross at the green light, and then somebody literally comes up and says, "Wow, the way you cross that street, you're so inspiring." Well, I mean, I'm a full-fledged adult. You know, I don't know what is inspiring about crossing a street. Like if a person without a disability could do that, why is it inspiring for me to cross the street? But let's say, for example, there's a fellow person with a disability, like a gentleman in California who just got the MacArthur Fellowship. I think it's like $500,000 or something. He's totally blind. That totally inspires me. Not because, oh, he's blind, but because doggone, he just got a MacArthur Fellowship. He's a Mensa member. His IQ and intelligence are off the charts, and he continues to do well with his life. That inspires me. Whether he's blind or not, that inspires me. And that's the kind of thing that we have to be on the lookout for, because what happens is, if we're not careful about that, then the message in finding blind people inspiring, or any other person with disability inspiring, is that if the thing is, well, at least I don't have to go through that, or my life could be worse, or wow, they made it in spite of how awful that disability is to have, etc. As opposed to, well, you know what, they worked hard, they really busted their tail and they got it all done. That's inspiring, because anyone who works hard should be an inspiration to anybody, regardless of whether they have a disability or not.
That's right. Exactly the way it should be. And blind people who do the average sorts of things, do it daily, are good at it, and are successful, to me, are just as inspiring as sighted people who do it, because of the fact that they have found an equilibrium and they are able to maintain and move forward. Tell me, do you think overall, thinking back on it, that your parents had a positive attitude about blindness?
They did, because they didn't phrase it that way. They didn't want me originally to associate with blindness, because they were afraid of what other people would think. Because they originally didn't want me to use a cane, because they said, first of all, you can see a little bit. And second, if people think of you as blind, they won't give you the kind of opportunities and they won't expect of you what we expect of you. So it was sort of a different take on the whole blindness philosophy thing. And then once I started using a cane, it really was met with some major resistance by my parents at first. And then when they realized how much more confident I became, because I was taught by my mentors how to use a cane, then I was better. And then they accepted it. And now it's nothing. I mean, now it's a matter of course. Of course, when you're blind, you use a cane. So they underwent an evolution of sorts themselves as well.
And as you visit them, of course, you still have to do the chores, right? Because now you're the son,
yes,
and
yes,
you got to support them in the manner they want to become accustomed, right?
That's right. I still have to do the chores. I still have to, you know, like right now with this podcast, this is all being recorded while I'm at my sister's house, but my parents and I are here with my sister and her family as our house is being renovated. And so it's just nice to be with them. But whenever we go back to our place, because we've had that same house that I grew up in for 46 years, we've had that house. Whenever I go back, it's like, oh, Oli, can you take out the trash, clean the pool, work on this, do that, clean this up? It's the same, you know, because we're always our parents' children, whether we're adults or not. So I love the fact that they stuck with me, and that they do demand high. And the awesome thing is they demand high of my children too.
But mom, I can't clean the pool. It's frozen over.
Southern California.
yeah. Well, that's true. When you're in California, it's a different story. But you know, it's interesting to hear your stories, how similar in a lot of ways they are to mine, but in some ways different. My parents never cared about the fact that I was blind. They just said, you can do whatever he wants, and he's going to be able to do things like everyone else. And there was never a discussion about it. I actually got a guide dog before I got a cane, because there was nobody around teaching cane travel, but we met someone who used a cane. You've, I think, met her or know of her, Sharon Gold, who lived near where we lived.
Yeah, she was in this movement.
Right. When I was growing up. And so I met guide dogs, as it were, through her, and ended up getting a guide dog going into high school. But my parents actually initiated that, recognizing that we needed to do something to enhance my ability, as opposed to just walking to school or walking around a school, and being able to hear it in a much smaller environment than a high school would be. And it was the right time.
Yeah, absolutely. Sharon Gold was a force of nature. I still miss her to this day. And she spent 20 years of her life working full-time building the National Federation of the Blind of California. She has touched the lives of countless people who've gone on to touch the lives of others, because she basically built a leadership factory. And I continue to revere her to this day, even though she has left us. I strive always to emulate the qualities of life of Sharon Gold, that's for sure.
And you can't do better than that.
Right, that's right.
So what, you know, an interesting thought that comes to mind is, you've talked about people with disabilities and the fact that we need to educate people in society. What role, whether you're a person with a disability or not, but if you're especially familiar with disabilities, what role should we have in dealing with people who are blind or have disabilities in society?
Well, that's a really good question, because the fact is that we all have a role to play when it comes to making a difference. The fact is that when it comes to the disability community, there are more than 61 million persons with disabilities, including children and adults in this country. And because of that, that means disability touches the lives of all of us. And because it touches the lives of each and every one of us, that means that we need to really be mindful, because 90% of all disabilities are invisible to the naked eye. Mm-hmm. People may have depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, dyslexia, other forms of learning disability, as well as dysgraphia, dyscalculia. They can have an intellectual disability. They're just all sorts of things that you don't see. They can have epilepsy, etc. And so therefore, what is really important for all of us is always to be open to what it means to have a disability. There are some of us who, let's say, who've had our disability our whole lives. And to us, it's just a characteristic. And even within that, there could be some changes. Like in my case, I was used to what I could see, as limited as it was. And then when I was hit by a car and then the lens detached, and then now I see even less, I had to go through a major adjustment period, even as someone who lived with my blindness my whole life. And people say, well, blind, well, you could see. Well, just to clarify, blindness is blindness, including people who have some residual vision. But my degree of residual vision dramatically dropped, and it's beyond repair at this point. And I had to go through, and am still going through, some adjustments with that. And it's something that, so when I'm talking about this, I'm saying that as not as a part of a theoretical construct, but as somebody who myself am going through a lot of changes that have occurred, because it's not that the disability is the problem. It's that this level is of disability was just something to which I was not accustomed. So it doesn't mean that various of us who either acquire a disability or who acquire a disability to a greater degree of significance can't live full and productive lives, but there is an adjustment period that's required. And there are additional challenges with that. Does that mean that we have lives of unhappiness and struggle and necessarily having lives of depression? No. But what it does mean is that we have got to recognize that we are all on this journey. There's actually, Mike, another example where, as I mentioned earlier, I've been involved in the civil rights world within a disability and other contexts for 3 decades. Roughly about 4 or 5 years ago or so, the boys and I, Leo, Nick, and Steven, my sons, we spontaneously decided to take a trip to New York. And while we were up there, one morning we were at breakfast, and then somebody dropped a utensil. And so I say, well, hey guys, whichever one of you dropped that, you should pick it up. You know, and my thought was, hey, well, just because they're blind, they should leave it for other people to pick up. But here's the catch. What happened once I said that, somebody to the table to my right sheepishly tapped my shoulder and said, sir, I'm sorry to interrupt, but actually that was not one of your sons, that was me. So here I was thinking, yeah, I know about civil rights and about equality of opportunity and how we have to really think well of people with disabilities. What was my assumption? In all transparency, I assumed that it was one of my sons who dropped that floor. I completely assumed. So what I've apologized for that, but we all have growth to do.
Go back to your other example, though. You're crossing the street, you get to the other side, and somebody comes up to you and says, oh, you're just amazing. You cross that street all by yourself and how independent you are. What should your job be? Or how do you react? Or how do you think we should react when that kind of thing happens?
Well, I think it's an opportunity to educate people. If we get mad at them and get mad and say, what do you mean? You know, or if somebody offers help and we say, I don't need help, I'm fine. You know, like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, then all they're going to walk away is they'll think, dang, those people with disabilities are pretty bitter, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And the thing is, by nature, all of us, we tend to judge either people or classifications of people based on the negative characteristic that sets that person apart as different from ourselves. So in this instance, if they have that sort of negative interaction with us and they've never interacted with a blind person before, they'll say, well, dang, you know, here I am trying to help somebody and then they bite my head off. I'm just trying to help, you know? So I think that it's an opportunity for us to educate people about who we are and what we can do and say, well, gosh, thank you for offering to help me cross the street, but I'm okay. But how are you doing? You know, they focus on them. Or if people say, well, gosh, you know, you're so inspiring for what you did. And then the stuff that I like to say is, well, you know, all of us are inspiring to each other. And to the extent that you optimize your life, you would inspire me. And then that's it. Because I'm sure everybody has a life story that can inspire me, you know, as the way that we can inspire them. But it has nothing to do with disability.
No. One of the things I love to say to people when they come up and do that is, you know, I got to tell you that you inspire me all the more because you are getting around without a guide dog or a cane. Isn't that amazing?
That's the best.
And then I then use that to go and say, I'm not trying to be sarcastic or anything, but the reality is it's just another way, or we each have other ways of doing the same thing. And although there are more of you than there are of I, and I understand and appreciate the inspiration, but the reality is it's no different. And it would be so much nicer if people would recognize that just because I happen to be blind and you're not, the fact is we both can do the same thing. And that's what's really important. Sometimes you get into really good discussions about that. But yeah, I love to say that, well, I'm just amazed that you get around without a dog or a cane and you do so well. But I do make sure I mitigate that immediately and say, I'm not trying to be sarcastic. There's a reason I say that. Let me explain. And most people stay around and listen, which is pretty good.
I absolutely love that. And, you know, actually, this reminds me of another illustration where, you know, some people say, well, why do we have to make these businesses open to people who use wheelchairs? Or why do we have to, you know, like sometimes businesses or other people, they say, why do I have to spend this money to make places accessible? You know, like they get all mad. Mm-hmm. And then I actually, this is borrowing from what a talk I heard from the late Susan Daniels once. Where, let's say, for example, people say, hey, you know, we have to make all these places wheelchair accessible. Well, you know, think about how much the world spends on chairs, literally, they're everywhere. There are chairs everywhere. But what do wheelchair users do? They bring their own. Yeah. Imagine how much money would be saved if businesses wouldn't have to pay for all of those chairs. Because imagine if more people use chairs, then the businesses wouldn't have to pay for them because people brought their own. Well, what about another possibility? I love this, what Susan said, is, well, what about, oh, actually, Dr. Jernigan said this, where, you know, if we really wanted to be good good with everything. Well, what about accommodating sighted people? Well, they say, well, what do you mean? Well, if we instead, with all of our office buildings and houses and everywhere, what if instead of having windows for people to see out, why don't we have no windows? Because it actually optimizes energy efficiency. It keeps the houses cool or warm or whichever. But instead, to accommodate people who can see, there are windows everywhere that so people can look out, they can feel the sun, all that kind of stuff. For us, we're fine with this if we're, you know, we're fine if there isn't any of that stuff. So it's all a matter of perspective. For one person, what might seem like, oh well, you're accommodating their people. Well, what about them? You know, we accommodate them. There was literally a time in law school when the fire alarm went off, it was the power went off in one of the buildings there, and I literally had somebody hold me by the shoulder so I could guide them out, because I was fine with using my cane to walk out of the building. So I would say, okay, put your hand on my shoulder and I'll lead you out. And they were completely frightened. They're like, I don't know how to get out of here. I'm like, well, I'll help you out. And so now all of a sudden things were turned, because that's our world, right? So it's just really fun. Yeah.
Well, there are so many examples of that. And look, what is it that's so different about providing coffee machines in buildings for employees in a company or electric lights? They're all reasonable accommodations. And one of the things I love to say when I speak to audiences is, let's really get the whole concept of reasonable accommodation down to the basics. Thomas Edison invented the electric light bulb as a reasonable accommodation for light dependent people. And that's all it is.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
And, you know, we make a lot of accommodations for people. So why should it be different just because some of us are in a legitimate minority? And the problem is people haven't made the transition. And it is something that we need to really address a lot more than we do as a society overall. And hopefully we'll make some strides in that regard over time, but it is one of the biggest issues that we face. I want to switch gears a little bit. You've talked about your sons. Tell me about them. Tell us all about them.
Well, I just absolutely love my sons, Leo, Nick, and Steven. They weren't originally my sons, though. I actually learned about them because a fellow member of my faith community heard about them, because his co-worker had a sister who worked as a school secretary at the elementary school where they were. And so he didn't know them either, but he heard that there are these three blind triplet boys. And he literally came to me and called me one day, and he had this on his mind, but he kept putting it off. So one night he woke me up and he's like, hey, Oli, I need to talk with, oh, I just need to touch base with you. And I'm like, oh, really? Well, what's up? He said, well, I haven't been able to sleep. And because he just woke me up, I said, well, let me help you with that. Good night. Talk to you tomorrow. He's like, no, don't hang up. And so he said, there are these boys that I just feel like I need to introduce you to them, because, you know, in light of your having worked at the White House and you're being an attorney, et cetera, I just feel like you'd be a good role model for them. And I don't know them, but I'm wondering if you would mind letting me set this up between you guys and the family or whoever, so that way you could just be of support and mentoring them. I said, yeah, sure. Well, I'll be happy to do that. And that's fine. And that's how it all started. But quickly it became apparent that we felt closer to one another than just mentor mentee, and we just had such a closeness. So a really long story short, I ended up adopting them as my own, name and everything, you know. And they were isolated. They were originally from Colombia, and then they came to this country, came to the United States when they were 3 years old, and then they were isolated in their house from age 3 to 10. Where they would only go outside to go to church and go to school. That was it. They stayed in the house, sat on the couch the rest of the time. Here I was, I came along, I got them out of the house and got them to be exposed to new skills. But what happened was, philosophically, they went from being victims of bullying to having no, and having little to no self-esteem, to then really believing in themselves, getting involved with extracurricular activities, doing a lot of stuff with local nonprofits, and eventually becoming Eagle Scouts. And so if they're the same kids, but the only difference was belief was poured into them along with a positive philosophy about blindness or disability more generally. And that positive belief is what carried the day. It did not create there was not an overnight success that happened. It happened gradually. There were a lot of stops and starts, a lot of disappointing moments, but eventually they just kept at it. And now they're all in college and doing great. So, I mean, I just love my sons, and it's the four of us against the world, basically.
What happened to their parents?
Well, the mother had a hard time taking care of them, and the father left to go back to Colombia and said he'd come back and never came back. Uh-huh. And so they had abandonment issues in that regard too. Yeah. And ironically, as the boys grew up, they dedicated their time, and we dedicate our time to talking about adoption and also talking about how important it is for kids of all ages to be involved in their communities. From literally when they were age 10, 11 years old, we rang the bell at the Goodwill bell, the bell, red, I think it's red, a red thing. I don't know what the container is where you put money in. We literally rang the bell there to raise money for Goodwill, which provided school supplies for kids from low-income families. We did that because we wanted to make a difference. And then we just kept going from there, just doing more and more stuff. And then now they are just, they've continued to be active and involved, and they've touted the message of how we, as people with disabilities of every age, we're an untapped resource, and we should really work hard. And so that's why they become, even now they all worked before age 18 for pay. And now Leo himself, he's been working for 5 years. He gets paid he's young, but he gets paid $22.57 an hour right now, and he keeps doing better and keeps getting accolades from the very top of his company and just lots of stuff. And Nick wants to go into real estate, and he's getting ready to take his real estate exam. Steven is wanting to support organizations by writing grants to help build up resources. All of them have done different things, and it's all because of the role of attitude and high expectations. And then now they're passing that along forward to other people. So it's just really fun to watch.
Well, I'm going to tell you right now, it'll be necessary and helpful, I think, if we do another podcast sometime in the relatively near future and bring them on with you. We have lots to talk about, being an Eagle Scout myself and Vigil in the Order of the Arrow. There's nothing like scouting.
Wow. Oh, wow. That is so cool.
We'll have to come. Now, did you do anything in scouting?
I tried. When I was in sixth grade, I asked to be involved with scouts, and the scoutmaster said, "Hey, buddy, I know you want to do this stuff, but it's kind of not safe, and we don't really know how we'd support and everything. But thanks for wanting to be involved," and that was it.
I had a scoutmaster. I was in the Cub Scouts some, but really got involved when I went into the Boy Scouts, and I had a scoutmaster and worked with a number of leaders who were really like my parents, I guess is the best way to put it. They didn't care about being blind. I remember when I went to my first Order of the Arrow function and started down that path. And part of the thing is that you can't talk for 24 hours. You follow directions, you do stuff, but you don't talk. And it's a time of contemplation, but I remember one of the leaders, actually the person who was coordinating that particular event, said, "Come on, let's go talk." And I remember saying to him, but I'm not supposed to talk. And he says, "Oh, it's okay. I'm giving you permission." But I remember Mr. Ness talking about the fact that it was great that I was there, and they want to make sure that I get to participate in every way. And that it's going to be a learning experience for all of us. But he was really pleased that I stepped up and decided to try to join the Order of the Arrow. And then eventually, of course, went off and went through the whole program and became Vigil and got to know him all the way through. And a number of our scout leaders were the same. And they all had that attitude, which was such a blessing.
Wow,
they didn't put limitations.
That's how it should be, and so that's the same with my sons too. Air scouting, I as tradition, whenever it was a first of something, I would go. But after that, other than that, they went on their own with the leaders, and they built their own friendships and everything. And I got out of the way, you know.
Yeah.
The other thing as a parent is I did not want, and I'm not the type of parent to hover. I feel like they should make their mistakes, and they should learn and get guidance, of course. But if they make a mistake and it's a wrong mistake and it leads to consequences, they have to feel that, you know, like they want, I bought one of them a cell phone, a brand new iPhone. He lost it. So I'm like, well, that's it. That's it. You're going to have to find a way to earn the money to get that back.
Yeah.
You know, and then he had to find a way to work and he got it back eventually.
Well, and the point is that you are there and I would intuit that they know they can come and talk to you about anything and that you will be helpful and advise, but you don't hover a helicopter.
Uh-uh. The only time I like to hover is if I'm in a helicopter, which I love.
That's well, there you go. There is that. I have flown an airplane, but I've not flown a helicopter yet.
Oh, it's a whole different feeling. It's
really I've been cool. in a helicopter, but I've never flown one.
Oh, I'm not planning on flying one myself.
Oh,
so.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know that I want to do that. I have flown an airplane. I've been in a couple of different aircraft where I sat in the co-pilot seat and the pilot said, you want to try it? And I said, sure. You know, we're not near any mountains.
Oh,
right now.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my friends had me do that too. It's a blast.
Oh, it is.
It's so much fun, but I didn't want to do it for long.
Yeah. Well, we actually, the last time I did it, well, no, not the last time, the second to the last time I did it, we decided that we would try to imitate the aircraft they call the Vomit Comet, where we got weightless and it was a prop plane. So we couldn't go up nearly as high, but we actually did do a little bit of a parabola and had about 10 or 12 seconds of weightlessness. It was a lot of fun. And I actually did that and did it more by feel than anything else, but we made sure we stayed way above the ground.
Okay, well, that's good. And obviously it turned out well.
yeah, we're still here, which is really good. You know, it's important, I think, to talk about all this that we're dealing with about blindness and so on. It's, I think, extremely necessary for people to understand that we're people like everyone else. And I can tell you right now, I know we're not going to finish this today, and I'm going to definitely want you back to continue the discussions. But what I would like to do a little bit is get into some of the things that you've done since you got your law degree. You've been involved in a number of government activities and so on. Tell us a little bit about that and some of the adventures, if you will, that you've had along the way.
Well, originally I had no intention of doing work in the disability rights world. I had other thoughts about what I wanted to do. I wanted to go into family law, but that was just too gut-wrenching. And I went home crying every day. So I'm like, I just can't do this. And then eventually I got involved with the disability rights world by working in California at the Disability Rights Legal Center for 3 years mm-hmm. and built a program there. That drew the attention of folks in Washington. And I got recruited to become general counsel and director of programs for the American Association of People with Disabilities that had a membership at the time of 70,000. And so Andy Imperato changed mm-hmm. my life by bringing me there. And I directed what's called Disability Mentoring Day. And at the time that I took it over, it had participation of 1,600 students. Within 3 years, with no funding increase, I increased it to 10,000 mentees and 10,000 mentors. And involved people not only in the United States, but in 19 foreign countries all around the world. And so that drew some other attention. And then I became a special assistant to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Justice, then special counsel. And I also worked at the White House as Associate Director for Domestic Policy covering disability issues. That was a blast. Oh, my gosh, that was so much fun. A lot of work, but a lot of fun. Then eventually I came back. From that, went back to the Justice Department, and somewhere in between there, I also had appointments to the as vice chair of the President's Committee for People with Intellectual Disabilities, and then later I served as a member of the committee too. And then I then went to the Department of Education, and I've been there as special assistant to, in the office of the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights. So I've been around this all this for 17 years, and I've built relationships with literally thousands of nonprofit leaders across the country. And I've been literally by this point to 41 states or 42 states by this point, and gotten to speak to more than 58,000 people all across the country. And I just really have loved it. And that's in addition to the businesses that we have, as well as other things. So we have a really, really, really full life with a lot going on.
Haven't decided to run for Congress yet, huh?
Running for office is coming.
That would be an interesting experience. It's, you know, Washington is its own challenge, of course, especially right now. What do you think, and I'm not talking about taking political sides, but in a sense, it's probably relevant to ask given how people view disabilities and so on, but what do you think about the whole fact that there is such a schism and no room for discussion or really interaction anymore in the Washington and the whole political arena? And again, it's not an issue of sides, but it's just all around us now.
Yeah, and there's actually a phenomenon behind all of that. It ties to social media. What Facebook and Twitter or Facebook did is they added the like button. I think it was back in 2009. And so what ended up happening is it started to drive people wanting to get likes. And so what ended up happening is it created over time a polarization effect where people would just start taking positions, and anybody who felt adverse to those positions, they would block them, et cetera. Something happened to me relatively recently where I just stated an opinion to try to be helpful, and somebody threatened to block me. And I just thought, well, heck, forget this. I'm just going to just do it myself. Yeah. If you're going to threaten to cancel me, forget it. You know?
Yeah.
And it's tough. And the thing is, I'm very bipartisan, and I really believe that the secret to our power as a community is to really find ways truly to come together, not just in by talking about it, but by finding things that we can do in collaboration with one another. If we even focus just on that alone, that's more than enough work than we have lifetimes to get done. And if we were to focus on those areas of commonality, we really could find a way to move forward together. And I found that to be the case. And so, you know, I really choose to be not only bipartisan, but very proudly so, where just because somebody has a political affiliation different from mine doesn't mean that they're the enemy, or doesn't mean that they have all bad ideas. And I mean, it's more of a whole construct of how there's an idea, then there's another idea, then together dialectically, then it creates something brand new. Then that's becomes the new idea. And we just repeat the process. And collaboration has been at the heart of how I've operated my personal life, professional life, every part of my life. And it's just been the biggest blessing to really just to respect people for whatever differences, and not to attack them for having differences, and then to find ways that we can work together and to build on that.
We just don't know the art of conversation anymore, which is a real challenge. And it's extremely unfortunate that we have forgotten or choose not to remember how to talk to other people and have respectful disagreements. I just, before we started this podcast, I'm shifting gears again just a little bit as part of this discussion, but I had a conversation with the Homeowners Association where I live, and I called to say, your website is inaccessible. And then what's one of the things that's occurring is that there is a move, and a good one, to purchase the country club that the association does not own it. It's owned by a private company, but they want to sell it. There are outside concerns who want to buy the property and so on and tear it down and build more homes. They also get the water rights to Spring Valley Lake where we live, which none of us want. And then there are a lot of us in the association who want the association to buy it. And the association is actually working toward that. They put out a website that has a survey that's been dealt with. And now there is a way that you can go on the website and solicit or request a proxy ballot or a ballot to vote, and it's not accessible. So I called and talked to the general manager, and he said, well, I'm going to have to call our attorney because you said we're violating the law. And he said, what law are we violating? I said, you are familiar with the Americans with Disabilities Act, aren't you? And he really isn't. But you're violating the law. I'm not talking about suing you. I'm just wanting you to make the website accessible. But even there, the defenses go up, and it's so very difficult to get anybody to communicate about anything. And it's not magical and the most logical and sensible thing in the world to want to make your website accessible. But the big defense that he used is, I've been here 14 years. Nobody's ever complained about it before. What? And I said, yeah. Why should that matter?
Yeah, I've heard that before. Like businesses complain, say, I've never had a wheelchair user try to come into my restaurant. Well, did it occur to them that because it's not accessible?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really unfortunate. But it's all part of the educational system. And we do need to be part of the solution, not be part of the problem.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that actually brings to mind all of these different efforts that Accessibi has been engaging in, especially from everything that I've read and seen and from having spent time with the team and everything. So many things are happening at a proactive level. I mean, the way that Accessibi makes its services available to nonprofits for free, the way that companies have jumped on board with really pushing for accessibility in a way that never has been done in mass, the way it's being done now, the way there are partnership opportunities that are happening between accessibility and different stakeholders and how there's always an effort to engage in dialogue. And the way that the company grows as it learns the community and so forth. I mean, I just love that. I mean, to me, whenever we look at efforts for all of us as we grow, we just need to keep working on getting better and better and better and better every day. Every day. If we ever think that we know it all, then we don't. That's proof that we don't, if ever we ever think that. And so I just really think that the efforts of accessibility to continually to grow, just as is true with other companies who strive to grow, that if there's always that commitment to ongoing improvement, then that's truly how the disability community will benefit. It's how businesses will benefit and how it's a win-win for all of us. Speaking of unity, since we've been talking about that, because then everybody can gain better access. That means that people can purchase products and services that companies offer. It means that nonprofits can be more accessible to people who otherwise wouldn't have the same access to information. It means that it helps them to advance compliance with the law, but even beyond compliance, just the spirit of inclusion. And so, I mean, this world is changing, and it's changing really fast and in a good way, it seems.
You know, we could go on forever, but I'm going to go ahead and suggest that we stop because we have now been talking for an hour. But
what?
I would.
Holy cat.
Can you believe it?
No.
But I would like to have you back on again soon because I'd like to continue exactly where we left off. And there's so much more to talk about and so many stories to tell. So would you be willing to come back?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Great. Then I will ask this, though, if people want to reach out to you and communicate with you, how do they do that?
Oh, thank you. If people in the United States send a text to 313131, and in the body of the put the message, type in my nickname, Oli, OLLIE, and send it, that'll be a way that you will have, you'll be able to reach me every way, social media, telephone, email, and so forth. So I really would love to get to hear from you. And as your listeners reach out because of this podcast, I'd love for them to let me know that they heard of, that they're reaching out because of having heard of this conversation here. And I will do whatever I can to be of support to whoever needs it.
Well, and of course that leads right into, for those who are listening, we hope that you'll go to wherever you're getting the podcast and rate us and give us a 5-star rating and that you will tell other people about it. We will have Oli back on again soon, I promise. We'll work on schedules and see how quickly we can get it done since I know he's around for a little while before he leaves California. And he admitted he's on vacation, so he hasn't heard the last of me in the next couple of days. But I want to thank everyone for listening to Unstoppable Mindset. And clearly, Ole is as unstoppable as it gets. And I'm really also looking forward to meeting your three boys. I think that'll be a hoot.
Well, that'll be a blast. Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you. And Ole, thank you very much for being here. Hobie's on my mind. Hobie Wedler was another person we interviewed. Do you know Hobie?
No.
He's a blind chemist.
Wow.
And again, a really dynamic and incredibly powerful individual and a lot of good stories. But Ole, thank you very much for being with us. Thank you all for listening, and tune in again next week for another edition of Unstoppable Mindset. And who knows, if we get it done in time, maybe it'll be Ole. Thank you all for listening. You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.